City is a proud sponsor of Speakeasy. For access to live music, sports, dining, family entertainment, and more, visit cityprivatepass.com.
At last.
At last.
Let's get right to the quick of it all. The title of your book, Universal Tone. Where did that title come from?
John Coltrane.
Okay.
John Coltrane is, I think out of all the incredible musicians that we know, he and Bob Marley and Michael Jackson, certain people have that tone that immediately brings collective commonality with all people. It gets rid of generations and barriers, and you immediately become trusting with your heart. And you love, you surrender in one note, because everyone has a forgotten song inside of them. And when you hear the universal tone, then you hear the forgotten song about you. The forgotten song is that you are significant and meaningful, and you are worthy of something supreme. Whether you believe in God or not, this is not happening just, there is an architect to divinity and sacredness and holiness. And I know in your time, you've seen it, you heard it through Martin Luther King and Aretha, and of course Coltrane. So it's called the Universal Tone because I wanted to remind people that everyone was born with the universal tone. It's just that very few people implement it and utilize it.
You refer an awful lot to Coltrane and to Miles and to Thelonious and to some of the truly great artists of our time. Have you ever met any of them?
Mainly Miles and Wayne and Herbie.
Herbie Hancock,
yeah. Yes. Mr. Max Roach. I had the privilege to play with him one time with Jamaluddin Takuma in 81. And I learned so much just being in the presence of them. I immediately felt my heart expanding, what we call taking the hamster out of the cage. And you really hear, you know, stuff beyond being born in Mexico or Tijuana. You hear the sound of... you know, I mean, it seems like here in America, we forget or we take it for granted that this land gave birth to a language, Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, you know, that is forever. It's not disposable sound bites. It's memorable forever music. And it's a shame. Hopefully with this program, people will understand that this conversation... that we want to uphold that sound and that frequency and that brilliant elegance and genius of thinking with a different mind. That's what I learn every time I'm in their presence, still to this day, with Mr. Wayne Shorter or Mr. Herbie Hancock, you know, or with you. You know, I immediately feel, and I feel my heart expanding like an ocean. You know, instead of being a little lake or a pool or a bathtub, like Bruce Lee used to say, you know, I become more aware of my absoluteness. Everyone has absoluteness. But this world constantly wants to convince you that you're less than nothing, that you're insignificant, that you're a sinner. Whoa. And that you're not worthy of God's grace. Or worse, that you're... a mistake of nature. Huh?
But I tell you, when you look at the forces that exploit fear, and exploit loneliness, and exploit people who are truly ground under, it isn't a condition in which the victims of that scenario that I just tried to describe made the choice to be there. There are forces that work at keeping people in a state of oppression. The forces that are powerful divide, conquer. How do people find the path to come together to resist those forces?
Thank you for asking that question. I think that if my brother Robin Williams would have heard that question, he would understand that there's always a key, a golden key, to take you out of depression and frustration and suicidal voices. Everyone has suicidal voices at the moment of what I think Donny Hathaway or Marvin Gaye called the darkest night of the soul. We all go to the darkest night of the soul. And every human being has to be tested. I was told, when you go through hell, don't take pictures and show them to your friends. Hell can be dispelled. Oh, here it is. Hell can be dispelled in a sacred moment by chanting, I am that I am. I am the light. Or play I Love Supreme by John Coltrane over and over. There's a remedy to stopping the voices, of stupid accusing you of being less than nothing and throw you in a ditch and laugh at you while you're dying. You know, those voices everyone has, you know. But you have one voice. You also have one voice. That voice that says, I'm always next to you. I will never abandon you. And the same light that I am, you have. And with that, it's more than enough for you to illuminate yourself and everyone around you. That's what I hear when I hear Coltrane.
What is the source of that voice?
It's the core of your inner being who was implanted in you before you were born. It's in your divinity is your DNA. It's not in your DNA. Divinity is your DNA. You know, and I think it's a new way of thinking where through the imagine being born in this planet when if you just say the world is round, they would hurt you. Well, God or whatever people want to believe in does not require sacrifice in the cross or the concept of sin. That was created by a twisted, distorted mind. God is love and light only. And I know a lot of people get upset, especially fundamental people, when I speak what I speak. But I don't give a damn. You know, with light and love, you can create blessings and miracles. It's a miracle to be in your presence. I have loved you since I first came to the United States in 1963, and I saw you with Martin Luther King. And you know, to me, yourself, Dolores Huerta, and Cesar Chavez. You know, on one hand, I love B.B. King and John Lee Hooker and Lightning Hopkins and Tito Puente. And I'm mentioning, everything that I mentioned has to do with Africa, because that's all I play. That's all I play. So we have these musicians over here, B.B. King and Tito Puente, Olatunji. And then you have Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, the Black Panthers, and, you know, all these people who have, I call these people over here, weapons of mass compassion, people.
Weapons of mass compassion.
Weapons of mass compassion, people. And that's who I am. You know, we did two benefits for the Black Panthers. And that was hilarious. It was scary, but it was hilarious. We come out of the limousine because, you know, our first album is out and like Santana everywhere, you know, so we got a limousine for the first time. And we come to do a benefit at the Berkeley Community Center for the Black Panthers. We get out of the limousine and the brothers with the beret and the black berets and, hey, man, I says, stand up against the wall, man. We're going to frisk you. I says, we're doing a benefit for you. Yeah, but we want to frisk you anyway, you know, because they have so many infiltrators, so many bad people, you know, betraying, so many Judas within their own organization, you know. So we're doing a benefit for them, and they're frisking us, you know, for guns. I love that their convictions changed a lot of things all the way to Mr. Nelson Mandela. A lot of people don't know that Mr. Mandela started reading about the Black Panthers and things change within him. And people need to know that the Black Panthers, they created many, many other things that are still applied today, like food for children before they go to school, you know, and many, many buses to visit your father or your brother in jail. You know. And there's many, many things that they didn't give credit. They just try to wash them out like some kind of low life, you know, whatever. But they were revolutionary in a way that they believe the same thing Emiliano Zapata believed. Mm-hmm. It's better to die on your feet than to live on your knees.
Right. It seems to me that in my conversations with Martin Luther King Jr., I came to him deeply cynical and very suspicious of religion in its organized state. As a matter of fact, in our earliest conversations, I informed him that when I listened to him speak of his mission and what he thought he was being required to do by divine forces as well as social forces, he had placed a lot of faith in the fact that the church would be at the forefront of the movement. And I told him that I took great exception to that belief, that I didn't believe that that organized religion as I had experienced it. I was born as a Catholic, brought up within the tenets of the Catholic Church. I saw the distance between faith and compassion. They wanted me to have faith in the church, yet the church showed very little compassion to those of us who are of color, and most of the brothers that attended to our needs and sisters who attended to our need really treated us in our community up in Harlem as if somehow they were being already punished by having us as their constituency, and that they were doing the best they could with those of us who were not, they felt, truly worthy of their service. And the harshness with which we are required to deal with the rules of our faith and within the church itself. So I began to look at the conflict that I had between the teachings of Christ, the philosopher, and the way in which churches interpreted Christ. And I came to an early understanding that Christ never had a church. He never spoke in a temple to an organized body of gatherers who needed to hear him. Mount Sinai was his altar. Walking by the River Jordan, the Dead Sea, and all of the things that we know. And I felt that the philosopher, Christ, was something that I could easily pursue and study and emulate and try to have central to my life. But I had to find a way to separate how human beings adorn themselves. I look at the church and I look at gold and incense, and I look at the ritual and the power of and the adornment, and I just say, well, Christ had none of those things. No possessions, only love in such abundance that all who touched him or heard him were moved by him. So when I told Dr. King that in the work that we would do together, I would understand that that he had his calling within those parameters, and I would serve him as best I could with my cynicism intact. And after that kind of discussion, much longer than I've just indicated in this moment together, he he asked a question, and he said, let me ask you something, Harry. Do you believe in God? And I said, yes. And he said, why? And I said, because I have a need to believe in a moral truth. I have the need to believe that something guides us between justice and injustice, honesty and dishonesty, theft and giving, you know, all of these contrasts. And I don't find that anything that I know of the church really services that. The church says God is a punishing God. God is a God of wrath. And his vengeance will come down on you. And we are the possessors of that realm. Through us you will visit God. And I said, well, wait a minute. If I got to go through you, I'm in trouble. I said to myself, of course. But at the end of this exchange with Dr. King, he said, I have the same feelings. I find, and I then eventually, through the service of his life, he was in prison in Birmingham, Alabama, and he wrote a piece called Letter from a Birmingham Jail. It was a letter to the clergy, because he had been condemned for being an advocate for those who were oppressed. And this stirred resistance in the community of the oppressed. And those who were threatened by this resistance saw Dr. King as an agitator, challenging the status quo. And Dr. King pointed out that his job was to agitate. That was his mission. That's what Christ did. You agitate. You stir up people to become more committed to their own liberation, but with the faith. When I listen to you and I read the book and in the many conversations we've had, you have expressed a deep commitment to a faith and a belief, but then I don't see you connected to some organized institution. Do you belong to an organized religious body?
Absolutely not. I think that Hollywood and the so-called church sell Godzilla very well. Godzilla is about fear. God is love. And God's church is everywhere. Under a tree in Maui, in a mountain cave in the Himalayas, in a jazz club, Minton's, you know, God does not have limitations by twisted, distorted minds. His effulgence is so, you know, people say, how do I touch God? I said, look in the eyes of children, pristine purity and innocence, where it's not tainted. Look at look with different eyes than the eyes who have been blinded by logic and fear. See, spirituality has nothing to do with logic. Mm-hmm. Logic and love don't go together. Logic is time and gravity. Those are an illusion. You are eternal, and I am eternal, and everyone here is eternal. Spend time with it. You know, listen to the things, read the things, even be quiet, take a deep breath, and in one moment you can feel absoluteness. You know, that's one thing that I learned about blues players. I love blues players. You know, to me, John Lee Hooker and John Coltrane and everything in between makes me realize that like a dog shakes water off, I can shake off heartbreaks, disappointments, failures. I can shake up all that stuff off. Like, just, I love to see dogs shake water off when the sun is hitting them and you see a rainbow.
When I was with you in California, at your home, we had an evening where we spoke about the use of artists in the service of trying to change oppression. It has always been my belief that one of my great mentors was a man named Paul Robeson. He was a huge force in America. He was born at the turn of the 20th century. He was the son of a slave. Excuse me. He went through the process of poverty, went through learning, got himself to be the first person of color to enter Rutgers University, graduated at the top of his class, joined every team in the in college sports, got every team letter, great football player, and studied law. When he got out of law school, he tried to become a practicing lawyer, didn't fit, went back to Columbia, studied even further. He came out and decided that, as he met Eugene O'Neill, the great American writer, he became enamored of theater and wanted to become an actor. And he became eventually the quintessential Othello. His performance of Othello is considered to be the single greatest presentation of that Shakespearean drama. And in the praise that came to him, it enhanced his sense of the beauty of theater and art. And as he exercised this gift, he began to look at the world of culture and understood that it was a fierce force. He always said that artists are the gatekeepers of truth. He also said that artists are civilization's radical voice. Anyway, the point of what I'm saying is that that early instruction, that observation from this man who was for me an icon, a force of unbelievable magnitude, I began to see that in my own life and in my search for how to best use myself and to articulate something that would be constructive and rewarding to my life's journey as well as the community in which I live. And I found that in the arts, I could mold that possibility. I could investigate and find all the different things that artists are capable of doing. And I soon understood that to stand on a platform and to manipulate the sounds of the evening, to manipulate the information that's being imparted had the capacity to move people to tears, to joy, to anger, to applause, all sorts of things that we could do that bombarded the human emotions, human thinking. Whenever I looked around for the artist that most compelled me, I found Coltrane, I found Miles, but I found others as well from the world of music, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. When I fell in as a very young man into the world of that power, It helped me shape my own reality. I understood how good I was not. I understood how good I would have to become. I had to find my own form within the art itself. I didn't think I was a very good jazz singer, nor could I do what Ella did and the way Nat King Cole and others did it so fluidly and abandonedly. I don't mean without regard for discipline. But then I understood that I had to find another way. And through Leadbelly,
yes,
and Woody Guthrie, I found the folk art. And in the folk art, I found how I could apply my sense of mission. When I listened to Woody Guthrie songs and Leadbelly songs, I heard people speak to the human condition in ways that Tin Pan Alley or the average pop tune didn't touch me. I loved Blue Moon and I loved Pennies from Heaven and I loved all the jazz grooves that I was privileged to sing. But it wasn't until I got to the deeper resonance of poetry and speaking to the human condition that I found my real place. In this context, I often say to people, I'm not an artist who became an activist. I was an activist who became an artist. And in molding my art that way, I began to find that I had a universal audience. I had a platform. I had audiences in Paris and in Sweden and in Germany and in South Africa and in Kenya and in Japan. And wherever I went, the universal power of music within a embrace of moral thinking and social purpose gave me an invincible platform from which to face some of the challenges of life. For those of us who are engaged in social service, the path is not always easy. Those who resist us, those who impugn us, those who challenge what we say, have the capacity to do extremely cruel things. My friend Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered. My friend Bobby Kennedy was murdered. So I saw the capacity for the opposition to become quite cruel in the resistance to a deeper truth. I feel that artists are endowed with the capacity to shed a light on this condition, on these facts, and to give people a sense of spiritual emergence, spiritual uplifting. When I look at artists who have maintained an awful lot of power, who command vast sums of money and vast arenas of audiences, and they leave the evening empty with no thought that lingers, nothing that uplifts the spirit, so you can have a hedonist sense of pleasure and groove to repetitive compulsion beats. You play a beat long enough, everybody will pat their foot. But after you get through with the beat, what lingers? What stays? What do you hear? What touched you? So in this context, for me to run across an individual like yourself who has the mission that you have, I then feel validated. I feel comforted. I feel a sense of camaraderie. This opportunity for us to have this exchange is the first time I've ever done this. I've never interviewed anybody in my life. And I just realized how much I've been talking. So let me step out of that room and get back to us. But I needed to say that. I needed to get to the point of view here. Where do you go from here? What do you see as your immediate path, as your immediate objective?
Thank you for asking that. My goal and my aspiration is to gravitate to luminous beings like yourself, Mr. Desmond Tutu, Dalai Lama, of course, Seven Woman, Nobel Peace Prize woman. I would like to invite Bono, Sean Penn, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, all the women and men in this world that have consistency of what I call weapons of mass compassion. And I would like to unite with them the way you united We Are the World. And all of us to have conferences at the Opera House in Sydney, all the way around the world, just like you celebrate 2000, year 2000, you celebrated all the way around the world. People were trying to sow fear that even that day. You know? But I like to have 2 to 3 times a year conferences around the world, which something that I want to call intergalactic conference, because it's an inter thing. You know, the sound of Coltrane and Billie Holiday is an inner thing. It's not an outer thing. It's an inner thing. First you hear it, and then you can articulate it, you know? I also want to be able to have a church, if you call it that, when my mechanics leave me, like they left my father. But I can articulate. See, you haven't been talking. You've been sharing light with us. Because everything that you share with us, to me, is not talking. It's not blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah is what rappers do with music that sounds like a broken dishwasher. God Bless the Child should be the national anthem of the United States of America. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Yeah? I know what time it is and where I am, you know, and I understand that there's a validity to Tupac Shakur. He grew up not too far from where I grew up in Mill Valley. He grew up in this ghetto. There's not really the ghetto. Where I grew up is the ghetto in Tijuana. Okay? That's nice. This is Beverly Hills compared to Tijuana. You go to Tijuana where there's no passport and no guarantee where you're going to get some food. There's places now here in America like that. I call those places desolated places where even the police don't want to go. But in Tijuana, when we first landed, that was my first, you know, because you see the eyes of, like, fear on another level. If an ambulance don't want to go and the police don't want to go, you know you're in a rough place, you know. But that's where I heard the blues. They call the blues God Bucket Cut and Shoot music. Cut and shoot. If they don't like you, they'll cut and shoot you, man. Wow. Because they don't want you to play some of that clever, sophisticated, other stuff, man. They want you to play the God Bucket, Lead Belly, Josh White, John Lee Hooker stuff. And I was like, that's my core. That's what I want. When I play some music, man, it's got to happen. Because if I hit that note like that, everyone in the world will be like this. Yeah. Because the soul always salutes the soul, man. And I don't want to deal, not now, not then, with cute, clever, or intellectual music. You know, I love you, I love Keith Jarrett, I love anyone who plays one chord. Like, one time Miles was, he wanted to show me something. Come here, I want to play you something. And he hit this chord on this piano like a praying mantis, like, bam, like that. And I immediately saw, we were in this desolated bar in somewhere in Manhattan. But as soon as he hit the chord, I was in the most beautiful Spanish castle. Then he goes, Spanish. He hit that chord and I was like, oh my God, like Sketches of Spain. Plus, sound has the power to uplift, transform, and illumine humans into a place beyond the illusion of Hollywood and CNN and every channel that sells fear. You know, and I thank you from the center of my heart because ever since I've known you, you have a different frequency. You know, sometimes black people and white people get angry at you.
That's the only way I know I'm doing something good.
And that to me is a good thing, because, you know, it's when everybody like just goes along, but they're not really, really checking you out, you know, it's something to be suspicious about. I think that what we wanted to transmit with this conversation is faith is the power of things not seen. It's the evidence of things not seen. A man or a woman without faith, you're in trouble. Because faith is knowing that you're indomitable, unstoppable. Your words. Faith is very tangible to me. You know, I can grab any guitar and make it sound like a beautiful woman that needs to be adored. I can make that guitar sound like a child that wants a hug. I can make that guitar sound like B.B. King, Albert King, Freddie King, and still sound like me. Because I love him, all of him, and I adore him. We're just about into a place where, again, I need to say to you, without shame or uncomfortableness, I adore you. I adore you because your principles are higher than religion or politics. I adore you because your modus operandi is like St. Francis de Assisi's. It's when I see you walk and carry yourself in front of many, many men, I say, man, I want some of that. I want to be your core and your essence. I wish Brother Barack Obama would counsel, he would confer and defer to your light. I'm still waiting for him to keep the promise of more education than incarceration money. I'm still waiting for him to keep the promise to stop the war. You know, those are the only two things that he won the first time and the second time, because he said those things. You and I spent a little time with him and everything, and I was told, my sisters and everybody around me says, man, you know, the country's saluting you. You know, they're all giving you an embrace at the Kennedy Center, man. Be cool. Don't say, you know, take the war paint off, you know? And I hear you say, don't take all of it off. But see, it's not a war. It's a consistency of saying we want equality, fairness, and justice. Yeah. That's what we want. It's not war. We want equality, fairness, and justice. We don't care what you call it, Buddhist, Christian, Muslim. We want equality, fairness, and justice. That is the spiritual operandum that we function with. You know, that's the sound of Coltrane. That's the sound of Billie Holiday. That's the sound of everything that I love. Equality, fairness, and justice. I wish that CNN would have an hour a day of you and Dolores Huerta. I know we can accelerate. Here it is, folks. This event, this conversation is about spiritual traction. Not shock and jiving and making excuses. Spiritual attraction is divine velocity. And when you make velocity like this, you accelerate a new dimension of consciousness in this planet. We can see in our lifetime peace on earth. We can see in our lifetime heaven on earth. We just have to put the right places in place, the right pieces in place. And just like we accepted that the world was not flat, we will accept that we don't need flags, money, or borders. We are one divine family, one love, a love supreme. Peace.
Much of the world has recently been caught up in the concerns with the mutation of viruses and all sorts of things that have begun to creep into our systems of health. And with this Ebola drama, I think everybody is beginning to pay attention to a certain impending potential disaster. And I think we're trying to find where to put reason and to put blame and to try to ascertain exactly what's happening here. I get the feeling that the way in which humanity has conducted its business, it has destroyed so much of Earth and so much of nature in our lust for greed and power and conquering, that we have forced nature to seize upon things it no longer can find within the balance of what nature had set out to do for itself. If you're killing off species, if you're ruining the rivers, if you're destroying trees, if you're having carbon monoxide in the air, something must yield. Do you get the sense that with all this climate change and with this change in those things which bombard us and bombards our health, that it's because we are paying the price for our mismanagement of the universe?
I think we invest emotionally too much in fear. I know for a fact that for every this, there's a that. There's a remedy to everything that we discover. You know? I like to believe, and of course people are going to think I'm crazy again. I like to believe that just like you can dissolve stones in your gallbladder by sound, I believe the sound, this is why shamans chant. And they give you some tea, and that tea counteracts whatever is happening in a conflict constitution in your body. It's important for us to invest on spiritual education, not religion, and combine the shamans of the world, women and men, and start with children, because there's a lot to learn from them.
I recently had occasion to deal with a number of young people that came from a place called Ferguson, Missouri. There were a bunch of young people who were part of a very tragic experience in that community. A young black boy was shot by a police officer. The young boy happened to be African American. Police officer happened to be white, and the tragedy of his death is still being sorted out with juries that have been assembled to sort out the facts. A lot of people in that community feel denied, feel deeply denied by justice and by the process of law. They feel that there is a larger expression of animus, of hostility from one group to another. If you take the number of young black men that have been shot recently by police officers, you get the sense that there is a class war, that there is somehow a line of definition between those who do the shooting and those who are the recipients of that violence. These young people rose up in protest to what happened in Missouri. And one of the things that gave me a sense of opportunity was when those young people called to say, we're going to continue to resist this villainy, but we don't know that we have all the designs, all the tools, all the ideas that can help us. Tell us, Mr. Belafonte, how did you and Dr. King and the movement of your time deal with this? That gave us an opportunity to delve deeply into the use of nonviolence as a moral force. Most people see nonviolence as an act of passiveness. And in this passivity, we somehow do not exert enough social resistance to the experiences we're having. Well, the truth of the matter is that nonviolence is not passive. It's a moral force that, in its application, forces villainy to find another way in which to deal with its own cause and its own solution. When the young people came in, we put together a group of teachers and practitioners in the tenets of nonviolence. What does it mean to confront the police? What does it mean to be arrested? On what conditions do you submit to arrest? And on what conditions do you resist it? And how do you make those choices? But they must be rooted in moral interpretation. But I think that this past weekend in Ferguson, you saw a huge demonstration of young people that rose up within the design of nonviolence to have what they consider to be a successful interlude in the confrontation with the state. Where the essence that's missing from the cure to all of this comes from is that there is no indication from the side of the state that they're going to take a look and re-examine laws that are punitive, laws that are unjust, styles of social containment that are considered oppressive. There's nothing coming from the state that suggests a mechanism is at work to try to alter the way in which the state brings violence to protest. If you take a look back at Ferguson, violence did not come from the people who were protesting. It came from a massive display of force and military and tear gas and spraying into the eyes of people these dangerous drugs. The state moved so aggressively that violence became the name of the game. How do you see using yourself and using your art, if you see it, in any way that can address the inequities and the absence of justice in this context?
Well, thank you for asking that. You know, I know for a fact that Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and all those countries who were under regime of very violent regimes called communism, they all changed because women and men, especially a lot of women, they went out in the streets and they said, go ahead, shoot your mother, shoot your sister, shoot your daughter. Shoot. And then the soldiers went. Then they looked at in the back, the big castle, and they saw the dictator, and they said, well, I can't shoot my mom. You know? So the multitude of women make the world go round. Women have the power to give birth. Women have the power to change consciousness. Women change Europe a lot because men couldn't shoot them. You know, they're you know. In where I am, I see three choices. In the first choice is to align myself with yourself and create a concert where we play songs that are assigned and designed. What's missing to me in America is the lovings. We used to have lovings every Saturdays, and Fridays, and Sundays. people get together with colors and balloons and children, and you dance and you celebrate, you know, the spirit in you. You know, now it's like lobbying. Oh, what is that? You know, well, you prefer a riot? Because we're having more riots than lovings. I miss the lovings. You know, where you play music and your woman wear colorful dresses and, you know, everybody's dancing and it's like, hallelujah, you know? That's one option. The other option is to protest more and more in the White House, like Brother Martin Sheen and yourself and Arthur Ashe and many, many of the Dolores Huerta, you know, because with banners that says, you can't break my spirit. You know, so you bring American Indians, you bring everyone who would go there and say, my profession and my job is not as important as being a part in this moment of changing history. That's the second one. The third one is a little more radical enemy, because I do have some Geronimo and Che Guevara and Zapata and Black Panthers in me. But that's not peaceful, you know, but it's effective to make a point that you can't keep doing this. At a certain point, Blacks, Browns, and a lot of people are going to say, man, you can't keep doing this no more. There will be consequences. That's the third one. That's a very dangerous one. But sometimes it's a language that I don't particularly like to. I'd rather go with a love supreme. I'd rather go with one love. Putting them all together, I think that the third one would be my least one. But although I do have in me, I'm ready to die for it, man. So, you know, I'm a complex person. I have three layers. You know, the spiritual, the practical, and the radical. But I'm all three of them, and that's where you get that sound. All of them are connected together. You know, Muddy Waters. I'm ready to die, man. Are you ready to die? You know, and when they sing like that, you say, damn. This is not how much is that poodle in the window. It ain't that, man. You know? So you get that sound, you know. Now, Coltrane is a whole other sound, though, because it's a sound beyond conflict and beyond violence and beyond, it's a sound so profound with the power of peace. I would like to graduate to that sound in your presence. And I thank everybody for listening. I think that the exchange that we have, we don't know, my brother and I, how much they're going to edit. Because I know that there's certain rules and regulations, and they sometimes the people are afraid of the truth, you know, but I'm not afraid of the truth. Yeah. The truth sets me free.
Yeah.
You know, I thank everybody. I hope we didn't give you a concussion from this discussion. And I thank my mentor. You've been my teacher ever since I can remember. I have many teachers and gurus, but I'm yet to find one who is so elegant like you. I love you.
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to have shared this brief exchange with you. The Universal Tone is the name of the book, and in it is our deeper reflections and analysis of some of the things we've been talking about here. I thank you very much, Carlos.
Thank you.
It's been a joy for me.
A teacher of light, I thank you.